Actual title song to an album by the same name by the Mamas and the Papas called People Like Us. So, welcome to Bathurst Pierre's Broadsides. And it's a two-hour show tonight, as it always is on Thursday night. Uncle Dennis makes sure of that. He comes in at a little before 8, setting up for From the Cream to the Dregs, which gives you lots of musical nostalgia. Better recorded than the stuff I play, that's for sure. But some of the stuff I'll be playing tonight will be from that era. So, hey, for those of you who like Uncle Dennis's times, my times too. I'm around his age. Stay tuned. Mostly what I do on this show, though, is talk and hopefully receive calls from you. The phone number here is 831-427-3772, 427-3772. I don't think we have a second line at the moment. Or not one that we can really comfortably work with. Donations, of course, are always a welcome. And you can send your nickels and dimes to us either by going online at freakradio.org or by posting a large check, perhaps, to Free Radio Santa Cruz, Post Office Box 7507-95061. Again, Post Office Box 7507-95061. If you want to leave a public service announcement for the station to play, they can do that at various times of the day and night. If you have a community event you want to announce or a bit of news you want to get out, something you want us to pass on to the community or something that you want us as a collective to know about, do give a message to us on our voicemail at 427-4523. Again, 427-4523 is the voicemail. If you want to catch me off air, boy, phone number city, huh? You can on the Huff Line. Huff is an abbreviation for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And it is 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, of course. But for those of you who don't have letters on your phone, mine are always disappearing as they have to rub them away. The number is 423-4833 to catch me off air, 423-4833. But again, the magic number for the next couple hours is 427-3772. That's the number you should call if you want to be on the air or talk about, comment about, criticize or praise, whatever feels appropriate, anything you hear on the show, or perhaps blank spaces that you think should be filled in with information. I'm going to begin with a few street interviews. Today's the 21st. This was about 4 or 5 days ago, or even less. I wander about Pacific Avenue chatting with folks and come up with some interesting stuff and sometimes some boring stuff. You be the judge. And I'm going to give you a little background, although I've talked about the issue a lot before, regarding the case of Anna Richardson and Miguel De Leon, two homeless musicians who are facing an injunction by the city, cooked up by the city attorney on behalf of a bunch of merchants and apparently police, who want to criminalize these two without convicting them of a crime. What a novel idea. It's been tried by other governments successfully. In fact, our government is doing it in Guantanamo, even now as we speak. Our government, of course, that's a phrase used liberally. The government that you are asked to ratify in a plebiscite with two parties that essentially have the same repressive program masquerading as alternatives. Anyway, that is something I'll be talking about at 6:30, the Santa Cruz proposed injunction, which is not happening tomorrow, as I had originally been told, actually as everybody had originally been told, but has been postponed a week. And Jonathan Gettleman, the attorney for Anna Richardson, will be talking about that at 6:30 when he comes into the studio. So we'll be talking about that. But first, let's hear a few street interviews and see what we can make of them. And perhaps, who knows, maybe we'll get some comments from you out there in Radioland.
It looks like you got a petition, right?
Yeah, we do. We're trying to legalize AB 390.
Which I would agree with, of course. It's the Marijuana Control Regulation and Education Act. That's Amiano's bill, right?
Right.
How are people in Santa Cruz responding? Fairly positive?
Really good.
Pretty good?
Yeah, we're getting a real good response.
Nobody's smoking marijuana in the area, though, I notice. So.
No. The police came by yesterday and said that they'd had a complaint that somebody was, and nobody did. So,
oh, really?
Nobody did at all.
Well, so, if they have a complaint, why would they come to you? I mean, you're not smoking. Did they smell your breath?
Around here, no.
But they weren't trying to discourage you from tabling, I hope.
No, they didn't discourage us from tabling, but they did say that if they heard another complaint about smoking, that they would kick us out.
They can't do that. It's not relevant to you. They should go after the complaint about smoking. They can't kick you. They can intimidate you into leaving, but you can say, "I'm sorry," you know. Peddle your paranoia somewhere else. So we're downtown. It's about 1:30 on Sunday the 18th. I guess we're at. It's the 18th. No, it's the 17th, and we're at the table that wants to have a lot of that wants to see the marijuana legalized in Santa Cruz and elsewhere in California. What's your name?
Steve.
And Steve, I see you not only have red, white, and blue shorts on and a hemp T-shirt, but you have buttons galore that says legalized. How are the Santa Cruz folks treating you?
Oh, this is Northern California, so we get good reception here. Santa Cruz and all the surrounding areas are coming up, getting buttons, getting T-shirts, signing up, and telling us their stories.
Now, the weather is really very nice, not as hot as yesterday, and it's fairly light traffic on the streets, but are people donating?
Yeah, it's going. It's not as good as yesterday, but, you know, it's Sunday.
That's the front.
Now, I heard from your coworker here, and you have two tables set up here right in front of the Ohm Gallery.
You like that?
That a police officer came by and told you that if somebody smoked marijuana near your table, they would hold you accountable?
Well, basically, somebody called them and complained that somebody was smoking down here, but I didn't know of anybody smoking that was coming by. You know, and that's what I told the officer, but he just didn't want nobody congregating here at the table and smoke blowing into somebody's store. And, you know, he didn't want to get involved in it, really, but somebody called and saw it.
His affair to eliminate your table, though. Your table isn't involved in that, right?
No, we wasn't involved in it. In fact, if somebody come by wanting to smoke, I told them to move on down the sidewalk so we don't get shut down, you know.
Well, nor can they legally shut you down for that, but apparently they can do whatever they fucking feel like. Anyway, Steve, thank you.
Well, as long as they're going to leave me alone, I'm happy, you know.
Thank you.
And it's interesting, what we have here are police improperly suggesting that a marijuana table is responsible for possible criminal behavior, although marijuana smoking is criminal. Seems like we're still back in the dark ages, which we are, of course. But to hold a political tabler is responsible for this, unless there's some proof that it's somebody at the table, in which case you issue that person a citation or arrest and tell them to keep tabling, but to come to court to deal with their marijuana ticket, hopefully by asking for a jury trial and thereby getting at least one juror to say, not guilty, thank you very much, and showing the district attorney and the police that they're barking up the wrong tree. And they best spend their resources on something else, particularly when the police department is being downsized. 10 officers apparently are being let go, or positions are not being filled, according to today's Sentinel. Hip, hip, hooray is my response to that one, at least in terms of what the police have been doing downtown generally. I'm not saying that at certain times police officers don't serve a useful function. My car has been stolen on a number of occasions, and they have returned it to me. I think on one occasion I actually found the guy who took the car. But, you know, in any case, there's a whole controversy, and we've actually talked about it on this station a bit, about whether the community has better alternatives than police to deal with the problems that it faces. But certainly in Santa Cruz, the more police, the more security, the more of this and that you have, the more likely they are to run around exercising authority that is inappropriate, and that's been happening repeatedly, and does happen repeatedly, to poor people in Santa Cruz, because the laws are designed to give police and those who want to use them, like merchants, conservative residents, and so forth, staff members who busy their time with cleaning out parking garage structures and making sure that homeless people aren't sleeping there even in the rain. Not a good use of public funds, and essentially an evil use of public services. And so if we have to lower the number of public services in terms of they're doing those things, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. I know we all want to have more and more money for the governmental services, no matter what they are. No, we don't. I mean, the majority of money, unfortunately, for the government goes for bad purposes, like military purposes, like paying off bankers and bailing out folks like that, rather than for helping people who need help and proceeding with projects that would help the community generally. Not that that couldn't be changed and shouldn't be changed, but that's the way it looks to me at the moment. Anyway, here's some more street interviews. And again, if you got comments, 427-3772 is the call-in number. And again, for those of you who want to attend the injunction hearing of Ana Richardson and Miguel de Leon, it won't be happening tomorrow at 1:30 in Department 4. It'll be happening a week from tomorrow at 1:30 in Department 4. That'll be on May 29th at 1:30. If you want to read more about that case, go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, www.indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, or you can just Google for Santa Cruz injunction homeless and you'll find the articles that way.
Well, I'm here in the shade finally in front of the Cafe Alfresco. Taking a break from his green piecing is
Matt Silver.
And Matt, you've been I guess here for the just today, or were you here yesterday doing canvassing with your coworkers?
Just here for the day, but we frequent Santa Cruz and Pacific Avenue pretty regularly.
And your objective here is to get volunteers, donations, a particular issue. What's the deal?
All of the above. Well, you know, we're trying to advance our organization's, you know, their political agenda, basically. The fact that what we're fighting for is the environment. And, you know, right now our main goal is to address the most serious issue of global warming. You know, it affects all of us. It's real, and it's really happening, and we're like to do something about it. So we come down here not only to sign up members for the organization, but to spread awareness in local communities and to, you know, basically try and get the public of this great nation going in the right direction.
Now, are there specific bills you're pushing for nationally?
Yes, we have a couple of bills we're pushing for nationally. We'd like to see the new Waxman-Markey bill. It's called the American Clean Energy and Security Act. We'd like to see it be a little more stringent, actually. It's not as difficult on greenhouse gas emissions as we would like. But
we're suggesting Führer Obama is waffling or weakening on these issues, I hope.
Now, I don't know if waffling or weakening is the correct word to use, but...
Chicken shitting out, perhaps?
Well, you could...
Surrendering to corporate interests?
You could call what you want. We understand there's some very serious issues addressing the nation and the world as a whole, but we feel that global warming is, if not the most, one of the most serious issues facing not only this nation, but this world as a whole and our race.
A million Pakistanis displaced by the drone attacks under Obama's new leadership might disagree with you. That's what I heard on today on Al Jazeera Radio. Since May 5th, I believe, we've had a million refugees created in Pakistan. But we must worry about global warming. Not one shouldn't be worried about global warming.
There's a plethora of issues going on.
Oh, don't use those big words with me, man.
A plethora of issues going on in today's world, Robert. But, you know, basically, look, I'm not to undermine what's going on globally by any means, but there are a series of environmental issues that, if not addressed drastically and immediately, the consequences will be dire. And each day we continue with no action is a day closer to the end of the spectrum we don't want to be at.
That's what I say about those Pakistanis that are getting killed by the increasing war in Pakistan and Iraq. But nobody seems to pay any attention. They're all too busy working on global warming. In any case, you're not really here to talk about that necessarily, although you're here to, you're organizing around that issue. But you're taking time out yourself. This is your break.
Most definitely.
In which you heard me kind of, brush you off on the Greenpeace issues that you're proceeding on. But you were interested in, you know, I think quite charitably so, given my cranky attitude.
I don't know if I'd say cranky is the appropriate word, Robert.
But, you know, you're interested in you say you have friends in town, you're concerned about how homeless people may be not getting a fair shake in terms of how their civil rights are being treated in Santa Cruz. Have you observed any concerns that concerned you?
Well, I've heard firsthand, let me start by saying, no, Robert, I haven't seen anything firsthand. But I have heard firsthand eyewitness accounts of, you know, malicious harassment from local law enforcement towards
our police? How can you say such a thing?
Believe it or not, as I said, this is hearsay as far as I'm concerned, but it's not that I don't believe it. You know, these types of injustices go on all over the country, all over the world, even in the freest, quote-unquote, freest nation in the world. And, you know, basically, I feel personally, not as, you know, not from an organizational standpoint, personally, as a citizen of California, civil rights are very important. You know, I feel personally that the state is already impeding on my civil rights with the recent, passing of Proposition 8. Not that, you know, I'm inclined to lean that way by any means, but I think that if it is a personal choice of mine and government of any type tells me what I can or cannot do, I don't like it. And I feel that if you are a local citizen obeying the law, respecting society and keeping yourself, you should be free under the American Constitution, do whatever you like.
And you're supporting the bum skunks and punks that are hanging around Pacific Avenue destroying our businesses downtown, eh?
Well, I don't know if I'd say destroying businesses, but yes, I feel that for the most part, these people have slipped through the cracks in society and need help not to be harassed. And we should be looking at what is the best way to rehabilitate these people and get them back into as a productive member of society rather than exploiting them and looking down our noses at them and saying that they're the reason for everything that's bad. Because you know what? They have very little to do with what's going on in the actual city.
Now, what kind of work do you do when you're not doing Greenpeace? Is this a full-time job for you or a part-time profession?
Yes, I work full-time for Greenpeace, but I'm also a student in San Jose, and I am also I like to play music, I like to play sports. I like to think of myself as quite an eclectic individual, but, you know, I think that it's very important to stand up for what you believe in. And for all those excellent people listening out there, you know, it doesn't matter what you're standing up for, but you know what? Apathy is the drug of the masses. Get involved. Pay attention. It's important. It affects all of us.
And there you have it. Have you had any problems with the San Jose Police Force yourself?
San Jose Police Force myself? No. You get a couple of local dissenters, but, you know, for the most part, the police are just doing their job. And, as much as they like or dislike telling us to leave. You know, they do it when they can, and when they can't do anything. So, personally,
San Jose police have told Greenpeace activists to leave. How could they do that?
Well, what we have is protection under the Pruneyard Act, which basically says that we have the right to gather freely within any public domain within 15 feet of a public sphere, basically. So what that means to us is that we can stand outside on the sidewalk or outside of stores or whatever. The only problem is if there's a customer complaint, then the store manager can call the police and ask for grounds of removal. Now, the issue is that there's no way to validate the complaints. So from time to time, we do get asked to leave, but you know what? It's our First Amendment right to be there, and we're always going to be there.
So you, do you leave or do you stay?
It depends on the situation, but for the most part, we...
Recall a recent incident?
I do recall a recent incident with one particular gentleman who was displeased with my mannerisms and behavior in front of a local store, which I will remain nameless.
You were running around beating up women.
No, I was holding a cart with a woman's young child in it, and the gentleman asked me to move, and when upon the third time him walking by I did not move, he became very irritated. So
could he walk around you? Was there adequate space?
There was more than adequate space, and I think personally...
Did he like your moves? Did he want to see you move a little?
I don't know what his prerogative was, Robert, but it was very interesting. You know, I've had met a lot of cool people on the street, and he was one of the not cool ones.
So what happened after that?
Basically, the police were called, and they said, you know, because there was a customer complaint, he actually called the police and the store, that we were asked to peacefully leave.
Well, they can always ask you to stand on your head and sing Swami River.
They most definitely can, but you know what? Under the Pruneyard Act, they were legally in the right, and as much as we disagree with it, you know, it's a site we continue to go to this day, so it's not like we lost that site. It was just for one day, for an hour or two, just because of the one complaint.
Well, you might want to read. It's not an act, by the way. It's a decision by the California Supreme Court.
In August of 2008.
Right. Actually, it was in 1979. The original decision came down, but
yes,
there may have been some modifications.
They modified it, and I believe it was August of last year.
What was the modification that came up?
Legally, I can't speak to it. I think that it basically specified just a little bit more as to the 15-foot rule, but as I said, Robert, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to the exact modifications of the Pruneyard Act.
We'll be getting in touch with you when you get out of law school. What are you seeking in school?
I'm a history major.
Ancient Russian history, perhaps?
Ancient Russian. No, you know, despite my pure half-Russian heritage, it's actually not Russian history. I prefer the classics, so Rome and Greece. Maybe a little Egypt in there.
And you, of course, have read The Assassination of Julius Caesar by Michael Parenti.
Michael Parenti? I do not believe that. I've definitely read the Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare, but I have...
That's the fictional play.
Yes,
do you mean, Mr. Historian?
Yes, it is a fictional play based on the tale of Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare many, many centuries later, but it's also a very...
Have you seen the Marlon Brando movie of Julius Caesar?
Yes.
What did you think?
I liked it. It's a classic. I'm a big Brando fan.
Me too. Well, there you are.
Yeah.
Probably some of the women he knew, but that's another matter. Anyway, is there anything you want to add about anything we've discussed you think that Free Radio Santa Cruz fans should know about, or anything you'd like to say in conclusion?
Yeah, sure. I would like to say that, first of all, I do not live in Santa Cruz, much to my dismay. I live in San Jose, which is a wonderful place. But you know what? Santa Cruz is one of the most unique places in the entire world. Everybody who lives down here really should take a minute and take a deep breath and appreciate how lucky they are to have such a cool, left-leaning place that is so open and, you know, eccentric as Santa Cruz is. Because in the world in 2009, there are very few places like this left in the world. So take advantage of it. Enjoy the art. Promote free thought and free speech. And you know what? Let's enjoy this town.
And don't be homeless, whatever you do. Thank you again. We've been talking with
Matt Silver.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
And there we go. Got the right mic there. Here's an interesting article around the issue that's really coming up and to the forefront this week in an Oakland courtroom. I think it's Oakland. It has to do certainly with the Oakland shooting, slaying of Oscar Grant III by Johannes Merzely, the BART security guard, who's free on $3 million bail, although he's charged with murder, finally, although his buddies who helped him kill Grant or were involved in the action, it's part of the BART police gang action, are at liberty, and not merely that, walking around toting guns and tasers and nightsticks and everything else without any significant accountability that I can see. But, you know, I read an article about the main issue that's kind of coming up that the defense, Merzley's, it's a hard name for me to pronounce, as attorney, has been bringing up is the issue of whether the BART police officer intended to kill or even killed in anger Oscar Grant III, whether he intended to just taser him. I actually read this article 3 months ago, but I notice in all the news accounts there seems to be this deafening silence about the about the realities of tasers, at least the tasers that the BART police carry. I'm going to read this article again because I think it really is interesting and relevant to the whole discussion, and I thought it kind of closed the door on this excuse. And the article is can be found online at the San Francisco Bay View. It was written, if I can read this, I'm not quite sure who the author of it is. The article is titled, Did BART Cop Who Killed Oscar Grant Mistake Gun for Taser? And let's see if we can actually get the name of the guy who wrote this. I think it was a man. It's a news analysis by Junya, J-U-N-Y-A, whoever that is. And it reads as follows. Just as in war, in extrajudicial killings, truth is the first casualty. We cannot expect to receive any reports except those that justify, excuse, or minimize the killing of Oscar Grant by BART police at 2 a.m. New Year's Day. It begins with the first report of an officer-involved shooting, a term that serves to evade the issue of circumvention of justice and remove the shocking lethality while assigning the killer a passive role, reduced to merely being involved in some unstated way. The Oakland Tribune story, Man Dies in BART Officer-Involved Shooting, is a perfect example. The report completely removes the killer from the killing and shifts responsibility to a mischievous, little self-willed but incontinent gun, an officer's gun, quote-unquote, discharged, wounding Grant. That's from the Oakland Tribune story. Now the San Francisco Chronicle provides an example of journalism sacrificed in service of police deception. Quote, one source familiar with the investigation said BART is looking into a number of things, including whether the officer had meant to fire his taser stun gun rather than his firearm. And I can remind you that this story was written, it's dated January 7th. That's about 6 days after the killing. It was before Merzley was charged. It might have even before he was suspended, and it was really early on in the whole matter. It took massive and, to some extent, violent protest to get this issue on the radar of the district attorney, so he actually did something. Continuing with the story, however, and the issue again being tasers, the taser excuse is so preposterous that the source preferred to remain anonymous. Why is the Chronicle printing unaccountable rumors? Yet the article begins with the official BART statement. BART's police chief asked for patience from the public today after video footage surfaced showing one of his officers fatally shooting an unarmed man. He found the footage to be inconclusive. So officially, we should wait for the police investigation and not believe our lying eyes. Yet unofficially, police anonymously spread disinformation that would have us believe that it was something less than murder we see in several witnesses' videos. You would think that if the policeman actually meant to fire his taser, he would have immediately admitted his mistake to clear himself from a murder charge. Why would the investigation need to be looking into that possibility? I try in vain to envision the policeman sweating under the glare of an intense interrogation about the killing when the interrogator asks, Officer, is it possible you might have mistaken your Glock for a taser? I'm sure the killer cop would fall out of his seat laughing. Why is the taser excuse stupid? 1. The manual states that the Taser X26 weighs 7 ounces. Depending on model and bullets loaded, a Glock pistol can weigh from 25 to 38 ounces. You don't have to be a weapons expert to feel the difference between holding about 2 pounds and holding less than half a pound. Try it. 2. Police pistols are all black, sometimes with a very dark brown grip. The X26 has bright yellow markings on it. It also has a 2-digit LED display. 3. The Taser, the X26, has a safety on the grip that must be released. The Glock safety is on the trigger. So let's review the minimum steps of a taser deployment. One, you pull out the lightweight, brightly colored weapon. You load the cartridge onto the tip of the barrel. The cartridge is fat and rectangular, looking nothing like a pistol barrel. Two, you reach on the grip and flip the safety up. The LED display lights up like half your digital alarm clock, then shows the percentage charge. Three, police are taught never to use tasers in life-threatening situations, ensuring that the tasers save lives mantra remains a fairy tale. So, since that eliminates the split-second judgment defense, every taser policy I've seen requires a warning before firing to give the victim the opportunity to comply. Police like to report that merely pointing the taser and issuing the warning is often sufficient. To accept that the killer went through these steps without realizing he actually had in his hand a heavy, dark pistol with no LED display and no cartridge loaded or to be loaded requires the kind of suspension of belief that we've not been asked to make since Plan 9 from Outer Space hit the screens. Most likely, the cockamamie rumor is spread by the police in order to buy time. It's damage control to pacify an angry public until they can come up with some way to blame the victim. Tuesday, the Chronicle amplified the taser mistake nonsense. Quote, Don Cameron, a former BART police sergeant and weapons expert who now teaches police officers about proper use of force, said Monday that he had watched footage of Grant's death and was convinced that the officer had meant to fire a taser. Cameron said he made his conclusion based in part on the officer's stance and the fact that a second officer moved away from Grant just before he was shot, perhaps trying to avoid a secondhand shock. End quote. Is there any end to the fictions we're asked to believe? Everyone knows tasers do not give secondhand shock because we've all seen those jibe jolt sessions where police hold a reporter as the reporter gets a sample shock from a taser. We also watch police piled on University of Florida student Andrew Mayer after he questioned Senator John Kerry at a campus forum. None moved away before or while Mayer was tasered. On the other hand, stepping away from someone pointing a Glock requires no explanation. The taser confusion rumor is now posted on Police One, a law enforcement website where, quote, you must be a confirmed law enforcement member of Police One to post a comment. The comments below are member-generated. Standing apart from the expected boo-hoos for the devastated killer is one skeptic arguing along the same lines I argued. I have a hard time understanding, he writes, how one could mistake a firearm for a taser even in a high-stress situation. The reason being that even though the taser may draw and feel similar to a firearm, one has to turn it on. What about the motor skills learned of flicking the switch to turn the taser's power on? Would that particular motor skill go out the window during high stress? It seems to me that if one pulled out their firearm, meaning to pull out their taser, one would wonder where the power switch had gone to when they attempted to turn it on. Should that not tell the mind that there is something not right with this taser? Now, this again is an article about poo-pooing the early rumor that there was a mistake by Johannes Merzeli, the killer of Oscar Grant, the BART police officer who killed Officer Grant, who killed Oscar Grant, the BART passenger, the African-American passenger, on January 1st. And I've just noticed that there is zero discussion of what seems to me some relatively obvious, and I'm assuming now they're facts. Now, I haven't investigated tasers myself independently. I'm just taking it from this article and just kind of amazed that there has been no response to this. Either the DA hasn't, at least no response has been reported by the media, by the San Francisco Chronicle, which has had a story every day about the preliminary hearing of Johannes Merzeli, murder hearing, for prior to his charge. His defense attorney is trying to get the whole case moved out of Oakland to a more conservative area where the officer will have a better chance, is claiming that the taser was sought, and instead he pulled out a gun and shot him. But there's been no attempt to explain how that could possibly happen if this description of the difference between a taser and a Glock is accurate, and I'm still waiting to get that. And hopefully I'll do some more research. Maybe the person who's writing this article is inaccurate in some respects. If we have any police out there in radio land who want to discuss this, or people who are familiar with weapons who can maybe shed some light on it, hey, feel free to call in. 427-3772 is the call-in number here. And you are tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org, and hopefully we're going to hopefully get a guest in the studio soon, so don't go away. Aha, we have a caller. Hi. Hi. We hope you're on. Well, you aren't on Free Radio. Pity. Try again, caller. For some reason, the line didn't. Well, there we're trying again. Let's see if we can actually. Hello? Hang on, let me put you on.
Hang on.
All right, now I think you're on.
I'm on.
You are on.
I'm on. Awesome.
Hey, what's your name, caller?
Citizen Kane.
So, Citizen Kane, what's on your mind tonight?
Oh, I was just responding to the taser thing. That's pretty funny. I haven't heard that excuse before, but yeah, if anyone that's ever shot a gun and shot a taser, they're obviously two different things.
Yeah,
but I mean, I think with the kind of stuff that most people are eating nowadays, you know, it's kind of just going to be the obvious result of this, you know? Like, the more truth can just be bent and truth can have, like, a perspective analogy to it, you know, instead of just being black and white, how it usually is.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm just surprised that with all... Again, this article didn't, you know, flash around the world, the one that I just read, but these are pretty clear facts. In fact, our attorney guest, one of them, has entered the studio, maybe with his encyclopedic knowledge of tasers and Glocks, he can give us a... As long as he doesn't point that thing at me, I think we can be. By their microphone. Do you have any? Have you yourself had any experience with either of these weapons, caller? Or?
Yeah, I've used tasers and guns before, and they're quite different. Just the feel of them in general.
So, what do you think? So you don't think that Johannes Merzli might under the tension of the moment or the thrill of having Oscar Grant down, or the fear of a crowd gathering around him, actually have pulled out his gun and thought it was a taser?
No, not at all. And I think the reason that people can even entertain that thought is the same way that our economic system, you know, entertaining the thought of just creating this fake capital is going to help us in the future. Or the idea of entertaining the thought that it's okay to tase him when he's handcuffed on his face in the ground. I mean, what if he had tased him and killed him? What excuse would they? He's aiming for. He was about to grab the Glock and hit him in the back of the head with it. I mean, they just came out with that report where they, some man flipped his van, you know, hit a cop, and they just beat the shit out of him.
Right. I was actually going to read something about that too, and I may later in the show. But
have you heard about Mike Walker in Watsonville? That dirty cop that.
Tell me briefly, because I've got to move on to the guest. But go ahead.
Oh well, the guest should know if he's staying up with local politics. But yeah, Mike Walker, just a dirty cop, one of the cops that are definitely, you know, promoted and encouraged in a
Watsonville PD.
Yeah, and then he ended up, there's all kinds of cases, you know, people getting beat up around here, and then he goes and shoots somebody behind a mall in San Jose. But while people are filing complaints against him, he's getting promoted.
Well, I know it happens frequently that those who are criticized publicly get more support from the police department, because I think they take it as a reflection on their integrity, even if they're dealing with someone they don't particularly like. I know that happened with Officer Lauren Baker back in 1992, Sergeant Butchie Baker now.
Well, something I think everyone should know, if they have a problem with a cop, that if you ask them, you can ask them, you can talk to their superior officer. No one's going to tell you that there's a form that you can request and it'll go on their permanent record.
For 5 years, anyway.
Yeah, and it's just horrible, because I've had to, you know, wanted to complain and just gotten the, you know, beat around the bush pretty much and not get any information. And then I heard on your show one of these days that you can request a form.
Well, that's true.
I'd like to make a comment.
And we have Jonathan Gettleman here in the studio, who has a law degree and perhaps an axe to grind. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Well, I'd just like to point out to your listeners that it is very important that if they have a problem with a police officer, that they do fill out that form, because what's available to a criminal defense attorney is discovery from the city of all those incidents, and the people that have been aggrieved can be called into court at a later date in another setting and have the opportunity to tell the court, the jury under, you know, the circumstance, if that's the circumstance, about their experience, and then the court can
use that to weigh the credibility of the officer and the likelihood.
Do they have a legal responsibility to do that? If you're making a complaint against an officer, do they have a legal responsibility to offer you that option?
No, they don't have
to. They should. I think that's definitely something that should be mandated because, I mean, obviously we'd have like a public committee that watches over the police, right? This is democracy.
No, we don't, unfortunately.
Yeah, so it's just crazy. When you really start looking into all these different systems and shit, I mean, I don't really know. If we keep calling this a democracy, we're going to one day, like, change
the
definition.
I've never called it a democracy. It's a plutocracy. It's rule of the wealthy is what we got.
Yeah, well, I think, too, it's like, you know, a lot of us
but
on the
I got a roll on you, Citizen Kane. Can you, maybe you can call back later in the show if
no,
you
I'll
want.
Just keep listening. Thanks, man.
Thank
keep
you.
Up, guys.
Bye-bye. And welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, you're welcome to comment on this. Did you hear me read the story by Junia, I guess it is, San Francisco Bayview, did the BART cop who killed Oscar Grant mistake the gun for a taser? I don't even think they'd even released his name even 6 days later, but because it's not mentioned in this article. It's interesting. But, you know, there's been maybe you followed a little of the hearing up there. Have you heard any of the news about the hearing of Johannes Merzeli for the murder?
I know the facts generally. I watched the incident on YouTube. He seemed very deliberate in his actions. I mean, it's very hard under the circumstances to not believe that he intended to shoot that young person. In
second degree or first degree?
That will be the determination of the jury. But I think that the evidence is certainly, you know, there if the jury wanted to find that he committed premeditated murder. There's certainly, from what I saw, sufficient evidence of that.
From what I understand from my casual reading, it's very rare for a police officer in California, if not unheard of, to be charged with murder on the job.
I would tend to agree with that. You know, the problem is that we've just gotten so accustomed to the use of not only violence, but the overwhelming force, shock and awe, and whatever. And I think to some degree, as long as we're willing to, as a society, to see the people who are being, having the violence committed against them as worthy of the violence, then we really don't tend to look at the actions of the people that are conducting themselves that way, namely the police officers here.
Or the soldiers, or the Guantanamo employees, or torturing, or the politicians, who are ordering it.
And it's all very related. I don't want to stray too far from why I came here, but I've been a casual observer of the progression of violence in the police force and the militarization of local police forces. And, you know, if you have local officers who are trained to be local police officers driving around in tanks and having automatic or semi-automatic weapons, then there's going to be some, what I believe they call, collateral consequences to the use of these incredibly powerful weaponry. And I think that that's what we're seeing, and it's shocking. But to the degree that people are assimilated to that use of violence and watch it on television and whatever, and find it to not be that big of a deal, as long as they don't personally know the person, then
you're going to get more of it.
You're
going to be desensitized to it. You know, I know that I was kind of pulling together some disturbing parallel facts. I mean, Dick Cheney's popularity has risen 8 points, according to the paper today. That's former vice president who's, you know, held to be a big force in the aggressive war against the Iraqi people that still goes on over there. And then you've got the announcement, I guess, that Guantanamo, the massive vote in the Senate denying funds to the administration to close the Guantanamo concentration camp that the U.S. has been operating for, what, 8 years now? Or 7 years now? And the word that there's going to be preventive detention as a sort of a mode that's going to be used for some prisoners, although I guess there is one piece of good news that at least one prisoner is being taken to federal court, finally, to be tried there under, you know, the system of courts that most of us, you got to have the money, but, you know, in theory, you have access to if you are charged with you know, this kinds of felonies and serious crimes that people are held for 1 year, much less 6 years, you know, and held in crappy prisons, much less intentionally tortured, as many of these people have been. So, anyway, I see disturbing signs, and I'm going to move on to the more
locally disturbing,
locally trivial, even in a way, compared to all this stuff. But again, we got to consider our own local torture situation. And people in, you know, are people in the Santa Cruz County Jail tortured? Well, there was a lawsuit won recently by Mark Maron that said that they're being improperly search stripped. There's a chair that holds them in place that they could be held in as a restraining device, which has some remarkable similarities to other torture devices that are used by soldiers and by CIA folks in other parts of the you know, the world under U.S. authorization, like Bagram and Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And also people who are homeless are facing a kind of sleep deprivation torture, and that's where we kind of zero in and come back to where we began and where you are spending your time, your money, your energy fighting the case of Anna Richardson. You want to brief people very, you know, kind of bring them up to speed, first of all, and for those who haven't heard about it, what Anna Richardson and her companion, fellow homeless musician, Miguel de Leon, are facing?
Sure. Anna Richardson is a young woman who is homeless and lives here in Santa Cruz. Due to the acute lack of shelter space, which I'll get into later on in the program, and the desire to be safe in sleeping outside, she sleeps typically in and around the Pacific Avenue area. It's where her resources are. She's slept at the post office because it's well lit and it's safe. There's history in Santa Cruz of homeless people being the subject of violence and theft. Basically, what,
and the post office is a place where numerous other homeless people have been sleeping over the last 6 months. I mean, not to mention in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, you see a guy regularly roll out a cot there in the back of the bookshop every night. And my compliments to Neil and Ryan Coonerty for allowing this to happen, although I've criticized them both very severely for supporting laws that criminalize all the other homeless people who don't have that option.
It's not untypical. Based on some of the research that we've done and the experts, local experts, anywhere between 89% and 93% of homeless people are without adequate shelter space, depending on the time of the year, whether the armory shelter is open or not. So the vast majority of homeless people in Santa Cruz are without the option of sleeping in a shelter. So what has happened is that the city, feeling that what I call the matrix of ordinances that they've put into place, basically like a spider web, in the sense that if you're not committing one as a homeless person, you're committing another just to survive. The city now wants the court to issue an injunction against basically the lifestyle of Anna and Miguel as homeless people. This is very scary. It would give the police the option of, instead of issuing a citation for an infraction, it would give the police the option of arresting them for violating a court order, which would subject them to immediate incarceration in the jail pending the outcome of their trial on a misdemeanor for violating a court order instead of just the ordinance. And in addition to that, because they don't have addresses and they don't have ties to the community in the typical sense, that the likelihood that they're going to be released on bond or any bond that they could make becomes less and less possible. So then what ultimately happens is that because they are homeless, they wind up in jail. And instead of being able to sleep outside peaceably, they are just forced into a situation of incarceration, and I think that that is totally unacceptable. Both of them are completely peaceful. They haven't been charged with any crimes of violence. They do their very best to have the least amount of impact. Anna Richardson actually volunteers at the Red Church on Cedar and helps homeless people with services, with eating. They just don't fit the mold of what the city wants to see on Pacific Avenue, and because of that, every effort is being made to remove them. And unfortunately, the options for removal are limited other than incarceration. There's nothing legally much more that they can do to remove them, and unfortunately, that's where we are.
Well, you know, I've we did a kind of a, I think we did a study of this, pretty thumbnail study, 20 years ago, and it's been done by other homeless advocacy groups as to what the relative costs are of incarceration versus even housing, which is more expensive than, I don't know, campgrounds or tent cities. They're letting people find their own places to sleep, you know, and gather where they need to gather. And there's some cost to that. I mean, there's some public sanitation problems that come up. There's some, you know, public drunkenness problems that come up when people gather together in areas. There may be littering problems that may come up. But the cost compared to the actual expense of jailing a person, holding them, you know, in jail is significantly it's significantly less to do something else.
I read an article in the paper, and it was by the new director of the homeless services,
Doug Lussell.
And I believe he said it's $27 in the shelter and $127 in the jail.
That's not the kind of a ballpark figure.
Ballpark figure. I'm putting sevens on the end of it, so it sounds exact, but I'm pretty sure it's right in that area.
But you know, I think as I told, we talked earlier about this on the phone, and I'm of the opinion that this is simply a terror tactic. I mean, and that is to say that they want to frighten not only Anna and Miguel, but other homeless people with the prospect of what they might have to do. Now, you told me you thought this could be a tool the police are trying to develop and the city attorney is trying to develop independently of this whole new three infractions and you're out rule, which is also a new power that the police have until it's overturned, I hope, by the California Supreme Court.
I think that what the police want, my understanding of the position of the city is that they believe that Anna and Miguel are not respecting their ordinance violations by showing up in court when they're supposed to. They're not paying their fines, which makes sense because they don't have any income. And basically the tools that they have at their disposal right now are insufficient to change the behavior. And because of that reason, they want a new litany of possible tools in their tool shed to guarantee compliance, and that is what brings us to this idea of this injunction, which basically means the court says, instead of just the ordinance, the court now says, I'm ordering you not to violate those ordinances. So any violation is no longer just the ordinance, it's now a violation of the court's order. So An officer, instead of writing a ticket, can now come up and say, I have a court order here, you're in violation of it, you know, off we go.
To jail.
Now, if they wanted to. Yeah. I mean, but it puts a whole lot more discretion in the officer to take them to jail or to just, you know, shoo them from here to there, would make them sleep in the bushes, which is basically...
We've talked about... you and I think, I'm not sure exactly, but I think we probably talked about the Santa Cruz sleeping ban, which is a municipal code in force since 1978, which makes it currently a $97 crime to sleep on any, I underline, any public property after 11 o'clock at night until 8:30 in the morning. And this is supposedly constitutional, according to the former judge, Tom Kangaroo Kelly, because it is allows them the option of sleeping during the day. So as a, I'm going to be the devil's advocate. I'm going to pretend I'm Mike Rodkin.
I'm just going to interject, though, before you be Mike Rodkin.
Yes.
I
love to be Mike Rodkin.
You have to understand that the camping ordinance has multiple components to it and that it is interpreted widely as any sleeping bedding material used to sleep at any time of the day constitutes camping. So, for example, you cannot sleep between the hours that you mentioned, But you can also not sleep in a sleeping bag during the day, or else you are camping. I mean, you have camping paraphernalia, if I can, you know, use that
term.
Well,
there's a higher standard. I mean, I've seen this law debated in courts and defended against and so forth. There are two sections called the sleeping ban and the blanket ban, which are only time sensitive. It's from 11 to 8:30 in the morning. The section you're referring to, I believe, is the camping section, which states you cannot camp with intention to remain overnight. The first two sections don't require any intention. They find you asleep after 11 o'clock at night, in on or under any structure not intended for human habitation or in any public property, you got a $97 ticket. But if they find you sleeping during the day, they have to prove in some way to the court, if you follow the law specifically, that you have the intention of remaining overnight. So the best thing for a person to say is, I was just catching a brief nap here before moving on. But that doesn't stop Ranger Wallace and other officers from misusing this ordinance widely to simply arrest people, or at least cite them, for supposedly camping, when in fact what they're doing is they're simply sleeping during the day, which is technically legal in Santa Cruz. That's been my experience. But I take it that that's not an argument you're going to use in court a week and a day from now.
No, we have other arguments planned that are a little bit more broad sweeping than how it's technically interpreted by police officers.
Most of these tickets are for sleeping, and most of these tickets are over 6 months old, right? These are old tickets. We're talking a few in the last few months, but mostly last year, right?
Well, they have current ones. I mean, they sleep every night. So at any night, the police can come find them and give them a ticket, and that's typically how it goes. And so,
as well as with every other homeless person. But this, I mean, I don't understand. I continue to wonder, and I guess he'll probably give me the same answer he gave me on the phone, which is they have this new law that says three untended to infractions, constitute a misdemeanor crime. So that they can jail them for that once they've convicted them. Why spend all this time and money? Because I assume it costs a significant amount of attorney time and money. And police time and money, because you've got how much, 27 declarations that were presented indicating that, you know, from mostly from police and city employees, a few from business people, that, you know, these two people were a public nuisance because they fell asleep. And then there's a bunch of peripheral stuff, like they had a messy area, they were trespassing because they weren't supposed to be there, they were angry when they got woke up and they didn't treat the police with proper respect, things of that sort, right?
Right. Oh, bring me back to your original
question.
And
the question is, why bother with a very expensive injunction when you just have a new law that's been created that just says three tickets, here's a misdemeanor, and that goes to, you know, that'll put them away for up to 6 months?
I can only speculate.
Mm-hmm.
I can't know the intention of the city. I assume it's just another tool in the toolbox. Once you have that court order in your hand, you can have the court fashion a lot of remedies. Stay away orders, jail time. It hasn't been proven to me that they can't use the civil, the violation of the court order as a civil penalty, in which case it's more of a compliance issue rather than a punishment. In the criminal sense, it's just a punishment. But in the civil sense of the violation of a court order, like failing to testify when ordered to by the court, you can really be put in jail until you testify. And so the question is, will they attempt to put Anna and Miguel in jail till they don't sleep outside? And how could they ever prove that they weren't going to do that? I mean, it just raises all these questions. It raises more questions than it satisfies, I think.
Now, as Mike Rodkin, our vice mayor, and I'm being a little presumptuous here, but not really, because he's been on my show a dozen times, and I've heard these arguments over and over again. He would say to you, you know, Jonathan, Santa Cruz is one of the most liberal cities in the country. We only 30 to 60 tickets a month are issued. You know, we have, what, 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people every night. We have 30 nights a month. And so that, theoretically, they could issue, what, up to 6,000 tickets. But there are only 30 to 60 tickets issued every month. So, obviously, most homeless people are following the rules in a certain sense. They're not sleeping downtown on Pacific Avenue, blatantly violating the law, antagonizing the merchants, getting angry because the police officer tells them to move along. They recognize that you have to camp lightly on the land. Yet here you are sticking your oar in, defending two individuals who insist on making an issue of this. I mean, is it because you want to make an issue of the sleeping ban? I mean, why are you... obviously, there's no widespread attack on homeless people in terms of tickets. If there are only 30 to 60 tickets issued a month for a couple thousand homeless people or 1,500 homeless people every month, what goes here?
To address your first point,
yeah.
I would say that I also believe that they say that the United States is the most freedom-loving country and the biggest protector of rights in the world, too. But, you know, looking at our current news, that doesn't mean, if you take that as true, that doesn't necessarily mean that we don't do acts inconsistent. So that would be my way to address your first point. My second point is that with the amount of citations that I've seen given to Anna and Miguel, I can't imagine that that's all the citations that are issued. If that's true, then they only issue citations to people that are so bold as to sleep in a place where they can be noticed. But other people have to, because you can't sleep in parks, because they have to sleep in places that are unsafe.
Parks are closed at night. The public should be aware. It's not legal to sleep in the Poganip. It's not legal to sleep in any of the public parks at night.
So then what they're really asking people to do is make sure that they can't be seen and can't be found. But that just puts homeless people in the precarious position that they have to endanger themselves to merely survive, and I'm not sure that that's the type of compassionate society that I would like to live in.
All right, Mr. Attorney, can you show me any statistics that demonstrate that the homeless people who are keeping a low profile are in any greater physical danger than those who provoke anger and disgust by their filthy habits of sleeping in public downtown on Pacific Avenue?
Well, of course, there aren't studies done of this all the time, but I would cite the city's own Homeless Issues Task Force.
That's available, by the way, online if you look at Santa Cruz Homeless Issues Task Force.
And the Homeless Issues Task Force raised the issue that there are serious, especially at the time of the task force, which was back in 2000, there were serious crimes of violence being committed against homeless people in Santa Cruz County. And there's a history of that. Second of all, part of what I'm learning about homelessness as a culture is that because you don't have a place to put your stuff, everything that you own has to be carried around with you, and that makes you susceptible, because you only carry typically the most essential items, that makes you susceptible to theft in a very easy way. And if you ever go inside of a building, for example, if Anna and Miguel ever come to court, they have to find somebody that they trust to watch all of their possessions, and they're frequently the victims of crime, particularly theft, especially for homeless women. They're particularly vulnerable to sexual assaults. And if you are forced to sleep in bushes under railroad passes, in the riverbeds, off in the hills somewhere because the culture of your community doesn't allow you to be seen while you're sleeping, then, you know, you run the risk of serious harm. So it's not as though our clients want to violate the law. It's just that, you know, in order to eke out an existence, unfortunately, they are forced to not comply with some or you know, some portion of these ordinances.
It sounds a little counterintuitive, though, because it would seem to me that if you want to avoid trouble, you would tend to want to be less visible rather than more visible. Although an argument I've often used on the air is that it's safer to sleep in groups than it is to sleep individually, and that if you sleep in groups, like four or five or six people who are kind of watch after each other's stuff during the day, and maybe they've got a dog with them, you know, because they want to. Dogs are often important both as companions and also to kind of warn of the attack of somebody who might not have the approach of somebody who might have their best interests at heart. you can't do that because you're then more of a target for the police.
Well, it depends on what type of harm you're trying to avoid. You know, and if the type of harm that you're trying to avoid, like possible violence and theft, and not having access to your resources, is more significant to you than offending the city's refusal to allow you to sleep anywhere in public, when only 10% of people fit into the shelter of homeless people, then you know you just have to make your cost-benefit analysis like everyone else does in every other area of life, as we've been taught, and usually it comes down on the side of safety and access to resources.
You spoke with me about the postponement of this case. It was scheduled for tomorrow at 1:30 in Department 4, Judge Burdick's court, and now it's going to be moved to, I guess it's May 29th, 1:30 in Department 4. What's the significance of this?
Well, once again, I can only speculate as to what the significance is. It could be good or it could be bad, but it appears as though that the Judge Burdick wants to take a closer look and really examine the facts as we've asked him to, and not just accept the city's position, which is, all right, you wanted us to produce some people that would say that these particular people are a nuisance. Here's a pile of declarations. They're a nuisance. And I think that the judge wants to, you know, use the scalpel rather than the bomb, or whatever, however you want to do it.
Drone.
They're gonna. My whole purpose in this case, and the purpose of our defense, and to his credit, Mark Briscoe has also taken on this case for Miguel de Leon, has been to hold the city to their burden. You know, if you want to put people in jail for sleeping, then you better prove to a court and to us and to the public that you have the right to do that and you have a factual basis to do that. And that's what we're trying to do. I just wanted to add one thing while we're talking, and that is the finding of the task force in relationship to the camping ban.
That's the one empowered by the city council and
right.
Appointed by the council.
And appointed by the council, and there were 8 members, and they unanimous...
12.
They unanimously determined, before the report was even done, that for moral and humanitarian reasons, they called it an imperative, that it was an imperative that the city council repeal the camping ban because plaintiffs, the city, could not offer shelter to the vast majority of homeless residents in the county. And that's basically what they're saying. I mean, they have a couple of other types of citations, one for trespassing, one for jaywalking. I don't think they're going to get it on that ground. What it really boils down to is the fact that they have to sleep outside every night.
You've asked, and caller, please call in again. You know, we'll pick up the phone. You probably there was one ring there. If you want to call back, you can. We're on the line with we're in the studio with Jonathan Gettleman. We have a caller. This could be Attorney David Beauvais. So maybe we'll have a question of attorney to attorney. Who knows? Hi, you're on Free Radio with Jonathan and Robert.
Hey, Robert. This is David.
Hey, David Beauvais. Have you met Jonathan Gettleman?
No, I don't think so.
Well, Jonathan, meet David. David, meet Jonathan.
Nice to meet you.
Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Jonathan, as you probably know from my conversations with you on the phone, is defending Anna Richardson, who's facing this injunction from the city attorney, John Barisoni. You yourself, David, have fought injunctions against the homeless for trying to sleep at City Hall as a matter of, actually, not even to sleep.
Yeah, I can't talk.
Are you there, David?
Yeah, go ahead.
You fought injunctions yourself, several of them. One of them was against activists who were trying to bring homeless people in to talk to city council members. That was around shortly after this homeless issues task force report was brought forward and published.
Are you talking about the Coffee Klatch?
I'm talking about the Coffee Klatch 3, as we called that case. And then 7 years before that, and you've been doing this for quite a while, you defended a whole bunch of homeless people whose only objective was to actually hold peaceful demonstrations at City Hall. They weren't even trying to sleep. They were just trying to protest. But the city wanted found some of them falling asleep and didn't want to use the sleeping ban. Instead, they wanted to get an injunction, the kind of corridor that Jonathan is saying that his client, Anna Richardson, faces, so that one offense will mean a possible up to, I don't know, what, 5 days or 6 months in jail, depending on the nature of the contempt. What's your feeling about that?
Well, it's diabolical because, as you just pointed out, once you have been found in violation of a court order, the stakes are much higher than they would be if you were just cited under the ordinance. So it's a very serious matter, and I certainly, you know, I admire what you're doing in defending against this, because as we all know, there's insufficient space for people to sleep legally in Santa Cruz who are homeless. And people have to sleep, and you know, normally people sleep at night so that they can do things during the day.
You know, this has been an issue in other large cities like San Diego, Los Angeles, Fresno, Richmond, and in all those cities, either through pressure on the city council by groups like the ACLU or through court orders and court settlements, the Jones settlement in Los Angeles, the Spencer settlement in San Diego, the Kincaid settlement in Fresno, and now Mark Maron's pursuing a similar case in Sacramento. The cities were forced to change their laws to at least allow nighttime sleeping on some public property. Why do you think this hasn't happened in Santa Cruz? I'll ask this question for both of you. Jonathan, let me ask you first, and then ask you, David.
I would defer to David. I think he has more experience in this with this issue than I do. I can only assume because the either the will in the courts haven't been there, or somebody hasn't brought the case.
What do you think, David?
Well, I know that we attempted to launch that kind of a suit before, and we actually had some heavy hitters from the East Coast who were going to help us with it. But when we were looking at the consequences of the violation, which was just an infraction, and then we learned that even if you snub your nose at paying the fine for the infraction, that the most that was going to happen is that it was going to be reduced to a civil judgment, you know, and good luck.
So just a fine that would go south and they wouldn't take you to jail and so forth is what you're saying.
Yeah, so basically, in essence, what it meant was, I mean, I'm not assuming that every homeless person has a bad credit record, but that was about the maximum that was going to happen, that if you had a good credit record, you might, it might be marred by having a collection agency appear for judgment. And with those stakes, it just seemed to me almost dangerous to pursue an action to deal with the sleeping ban, because the consequences were so light that they were almost, you might even say they weren't even punishment.
And I would just...
But now, I think with this new turn of events, with the injunctive relief being sought, that's a totally different story.
Jonathan has a thought on this one, David.
No, and I would just piggyback on what David is saying by pointing out that is the exact reason why the city claims that it needs the injunctive relief, because they are saying that people facing no consequences have no motivation whatsoever to comply.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way to make them comply is to have the court order them to comply and then have the court issue whatever punishment is appropriate for their failure to comply after.
Let me.
Well, they have another option too. They could make it a misdemeanor.
Right, and
then we would have jury trials.
Well, in fact,
that would be wonderful.
Well, they have made it a misdemeanor, but unfortunately, the misdemeanor is not sleeping. That's specifically banned by the by the code, thanks to the same activists who are testifying before the Homeless Issues Task Force, whose report Jonathan earlier talked about. Rather, it is now a misdemeanor to have three infractions that are unattended to. And that what that means is that you don't have to, when you go to court, it's not relevant, the specific infractions. All they have to show is you didn't make your three infractions, that they were sent south. And sleeping never comes up as an issue. It's a brilliant way of avoiding a juror saying you're giving someone 6 months in jail for sleeping outside when they have no place to go. And also want to ask both of you, what happens to the necessity defense in this situation? I mean, in a criminal trial, you have the right, in fact, under the Eichhorn decision, the court has the obligation to provide for, to allow the necessity defense. As I violated the law, but I had to do it because I had no choice. Jonathan, what happens to the necessity defense here?
Well, in the circumstances of an injunction, you would have a trial to some degree because you would go to trial on the misdemeanor of a violation of a court order under, I think it's 166 of the Penal Code.
Something like that.
If they charge it that way.
If they charge it that way. But I would assume, and when you do that, you have the right to challenge the legality of the underlying injunction. I would hope that in the case of these three infractions, you would have the right to raise as a defense that the citation wasn't issued legally. But you're right, it puts another layer of complication on top of it.
In a misdemeanor trial, that would be an issue. But what about with this injunction that these two are facing in a week? I mean, I haven't heard of anybody charged with this new three infractions law. I think it's just being used, as I say, I think the injunction is largely intended to scare people. But the injunction is being pursued, and thousands of dollars are being spent on this injunction.
Well, it's a great unknown, and I would be interested for David to chime in on this as to whether in this circumstance the court could just issue go by way of a civil contempt, which could result in incarceration until compliance. I'm not clear on that, and maybe David knows the answer to that, because that is a big concern of
people
mine.
People should know that there are two kinds of contempt, actually four kinds of contempt. There's criminal contempt and civil contempt. There's direct contempt and indirect contempt. But mostly the whole point here is it's really a powerful weapon that a judge has to make a decision. Although I guess in the case of criminal contempt, you get a potential jury trial or a trial before a different judge.
Right.
And so there's that issue. But repeat your question, Jonathan, again, which is?
My question is in the circumstance of somebody typically failing to comply with the court order, the court has the option of basically using the incarceration as a means of compliance. So, for example, if you fail to get a permit that the court orders you to get.
Josh Wolf, he failed to cough up evidence. He failed to show his videotape of a police
perfect
car.
Perfect example.
And they held him for the longest time a reporter's
they
been
held. They just held him in jail until he complied.
Right.
And I just wonder if that type of circumstance could be used here, at which point you almost become extrajudicial.
I'm wondering how you would accomplish it. How would you evidence that you are in compliance?
Well, my first question to you is, can they do that? I mean, is that a possible tool? I'm not clear on that at this point.
I don't think so. The reason I don't think it is because usually in that kind of a circumstance, what the judge is asking you to do is some affirmative step, sign the check or, release property or something like that. Here it's basically a negative thing. You're being told not to do something.
Well, let me ask this.
How do you manifest that you've complied?
Right. Well, let me ask.
You can be released. The most you can say is, "I promise I will never."
Well, David, let me ask Jonathan. What is John Barisoni, the city attorney, seeking in terms of a court order from the judge? What is he asking the judge to order Anna Richardson and Miguel de Leon to do? I mean, they're accused of not sleeping illegally. That is, say, sleeping at all at night in a public place. Is he saying that it's okay for them to sleep off in the bushes on the city limits?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because it's very interesting. I'm haven't seen an injunction like this in the sense, is that he is ordering them to not do specific acts in particular places in and around Pacific Avenue. So they want the judge to order that they not violate the camping ban. They want the judge to order that they not violate the noise ordinance. They want the judge to order that they not do these things in very particularized places. And it just makes it look like what I think is they're just asking the court on an arbitrary basis to just make the punishment more severe for a particular crime that's already under the penal code.
Yeah, which is, or at least the municipal code, which is currently a $97
municipal
fine.
Code.
And that's it's maxed out. You can do 8 hours of community service or $97, $20 fine, which becomes a $97 fine when you get to court.
Jonathan, let me just make one thing clear.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying is they would be able to violate the ordinance in some places without being in contempt. But in certain places, they would be in contempt for violating the ordinance.
That's absolutely right. So, I mean, the intention of this whole action becomes very clear when they're only being asked to not violate the law right on or about Pacific Avenue.
Sounds like a special merchant interest law that some merchants want to make sure that there's no sleeping around their place, even if it's on public property.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's...
So,
why were they selected out? Are they different from other people?
Well, that's one of the issues that we raise is the equal protection, in that the court is really singling, you know, people violate these ordinances all the time, but the court is singling out them just because the city arbitrarily picked them out of a hat of which people should be more severely punished, and saying that, you know, there's a ordinance out there that prevents people from sleeping and camping in Santa Cruz, but Anna and Miguel are going to get, you know, misdemeanors for this. We're going to have the court order them specifically to not violate what's already a criminal or quasi-criminal under the ordinance, you know, code.
I'm wondering, Jonathan, if it isn't a bill of attainder.
That's a very good point. My wife raised that.
For those who don't know, all you non-legal scholars, a bill of attainder is a legislative action that criminalizes people by name and is forbidden by the U.S. Constitution and probably by the California Constitution.
The only thing that I would respond to that, and we're getting a little maybe hyper-technical, but I don't think that it's an act of the legislature naming them specifically. I mean, you could interpret the city attorney representing the city council, you know, seeking an injunction against these people, possibly, but typically it's through a publicly passed act that, as I understand, bill of attainders.
Well, let me turn this.
Fire it off. We got a hearing next Friday. I like all the.
Well,
I
know. Something untoward about, like, I think you've already said it, enhancing criminal punishment for particular people.
I think it's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause.
I mean, this sounds like two attorneys conferring
right
over what is an important issue, but one which I think leaves out the great majority of people in the radio audience.
Right.
You know, let's get back to...
So let me put this out there, Robert, and maybe we can just ask some people to call in. I'd be really interested, because in the end of the day, the injunction process is a matter of equity, which is balancing, you know, the rights of both sides. And the question for the court is going to be precisely this. Would a normal person, normal, uninterested person, feel that the behavior that is being committed is sufficient to warrant the extraordinary equitable powers of the court in this circumstance? In light of the shelter space and in light of all the other things. And so it's really a question for the public, not for attorneys in a star-chambered, closed-off courtroom to decide. The issue is,
so that's
is the
where
public
it is
going to
be decided, right?
Well, it depends how many people show up.
I was just thinking about that, Jonathan, as part of the showing to make an injunction, is that you have to balance the hardship.
Right.
And what is the hardship to the city or whatever perceived interest there is in seeking this injunction versus the hardship to the person if the injunction were to be enforced.
Well,
and it seems pretty clear that you know, when we're talking about sleep, you know, we're in a completely different magnitude of hardships than we are when we're talking about the aesthetics, I suppose, of having somebody sleeping on a, you know, in a public place in the middle of the night when there aren't a lot of people around to observe it anyway.
So maybe if you want to put the number out, then maybe some people would like to call in.
I could. The problem we're having is we are having phone line problems in the studio. So unfortunately, we have only one phone line in. We're talking with Jonathan Gettleman, who's in the studio, and attorney David Beauvais, both of them attorneys, actually. David actually just recently defended me in a case before Judge Ariadne Simons on another issue, which kind of involved homeless people in the sense that I was a reporter gathering stories at the Metro about discrimination against homeless people and sort of arbitrary actions by security guards. And that was the reason I asked you to call in, David, and we've gotten into this conversation, which I think is interesting, particularly interesting to me, but I'm a little bit concerned it may not be so intelligible to folks who are listening, and they're wondering, what the hell are these guys talking about? I mean, they're certainly talking about, you know, should the city spend tens of thousands of dollars on taking two people to court for sleeping when they have no other place to go? And the common sense answer is, what the hell, you know, it seems to me. But in terms of actually addressing this case, you're not going to be going into court tomorrow, so you have another week, you know, to gather some kind of public support. And I know yesterday at the farmer's market I put out 400 flyers inviting people to come to court tomorrow.
Sorry about that.
So we're going to be there tomorrow to say, hi, you know, here's a lollipop, and come back in a week. And I say that to everybody out there who wants to support not just the rights of these two, but the rights of every homeless person to have, not to sleep anywhere and everywhere, but to sleep somewhere legally in Santa Cruz. What can either of you tell the community that might be helpful in both helping these two people and helping the homeless community generally around this issue?
Go ahead, Dave.
It's a big order.
Yeah, it's more of a political question than anything else. And I don't really consider myself to be a particular expert in how to mobilize the masses to effect social change. It always seemed like such a daunting thing to me.
Right. Yes.
And I think what you need to do is you need to capture the imagination of people, and the way you do that is to frame the debate in a way that strikes a chord emotionally with people who are listening to the program.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that means using certain language that brings home the point of how cruel and horrible this is. And I don't know. I don't have those words, but somebody should come up with them.
For my own personal interests, I will first, I promised my wife Elizabeth and my little new daughter Simone that I would give a big shout out to them while I was on the radio.
Hey, Elizabeth, so. Simone.
Yay!
There it is. Second, though, I would just ask that this whole issue, I mean, the John Barisoni and Susan Barisoni, for everyone that's listening, they are using your name in this lawsuit.
These are the city attorneys.
These are the city attorneys. These are the people who are representing the city in this matter. They are using your name when they go before the court and call themselves the people and ask that these actions be done. And I would suggest to the people that are listening and the people who are listening that want to talk to somebody about this case that you should not allow your name to be used in such a discompassionate manner. It would be one thing if the city was on the cutting edge of providing homeless services and people just refused to go because they just were being belligerent and whatever else. And we can get into a whole another matter of whether people should be herded into shelters. But
yeah, where's the carrot?
But even if that were the case, which it's not, then we would be having a different debate right now. But the point is that people don't have anywhere to go, and your name is being used in this lawsuit as the people, as who wants this. And so if you don't want this, then it is incumbent upon you to contact your local officials, contact the city attorney's office, and tell them you don't want this. And show up in court. You know, it's easy to become cynical and think that it doesn't matter, but the fact is that it's a lot harder for judges to make rulings that, and I'm not suggesting that Judge Burdick is going to do the wrong thing here. In fact, I'm
You're
hopeful that he will do the right thing, and he's already denied this preliminary injunction once. But I would really like to encourage people at 10 o'clock next Friday, the 29th.
That's 10 o'clock, not 1:30?
10 o'clock a.m.
Whoops. All right, I better make that change fast.
Better make that change
send,
on your
send
next
it out
flyer.
Again.
To come to court and show your support and let him know, if only by your presence, that, you know, this is not being done in your name and that you want to see at least a place cordoned off, or whatever you want to call it, for homeless people to sleep safely, because you shouldn't have to subject yourself to harm just to sleep if you don't have the resources to find a bed. And that's really what this comes down to.
The phone number for people to call, I haven't got the city attorney's number immediately handy, but I think Jonathan's got to leave now, is 420-5020, 420-2050. You can call that. It's a 24-hour number, and say, please remove my name from this lawsuit, and give your name and request.
Oh, that would be great, yeah.
Now, so if a lot of people call the mayor's office or the city council, that may have an impact. I think Jonathan is going to be actually you're going to be stopping by at, you say, was it 10 a.m. or 1:30 when the
10 a.m. is next Friday. This hearing was scheduled for 1:30 tomorrow.
So I was right. All right, I was a little worried I was wrong about that. But so it is at 10 a.m. next Friday. But you're going to be in the court briefly. You'll be around there to.
I'm going to show up after lunch because I want to encourage people that show up and didn't realize that the court that the hearing was canceled, that they be commended for coming and encouraged to come back next Friday. I think it is really important to show up.
And I think I know that you have at least two declarations from two service providers who are fairly prestigious in the community, though I badmouthed them both at different times on this show, Paul Brindell and Paul Lee, and perhaps you'll bring their declarations along.
I do have to run, but I would like to say this about both Paul Lee and Paul Brindell.
Mm-hmm.
They have dedicated their lives to homeless people in Santa Cruz, at least the latter portion of their lives. Paul, for many, many decades, he is one of the founders of a large portion of the homeless shelters in town. He has been on the forefront of that movement. He actually wrote the book, literally, The Quality of Mercy, on homelessness in Santa Cruz. He helped start the Homeless Garden Project. He's actively participated on behalf of Anna and Miguel. Paul Brindell works in the area of homeless services in terms of sleeping and other services.
He's head of the shelter project for 25 years.
So he's been very much involved. And I would just like to read in my closing comment.
Your peroration here.
Because I do have to leave here. But Paul said, in his opinion, developed over 24 years of service to the homeless in Santa Cruz, that enforcing the sleeping ban under the current circumstances is morally reprehensible, and as it punishes poor people's mere peaceful existence with no other option, when no other option is reasonably available to the vast majority of homeless persons.
And Paul Lee.
And that's Paul Lee. And Paul Brindell states, in his opinion, that sleeping outdoors and engaging in other acts related to homelessness, which is being complained of, which is possession of a large amount of personal items and sleeping near food services and other services, are not nuisance behaviors under the circumstances, but are instead necessary acts of survival where homeless persons face insufficient resources, services, and particularly shelter space. Now, you're not going to find anyone in this county, any two people, that are more qualified, maybe as qualified, but
except
not...
perhaps in this studio.
And I'll leave that to the expert. But you know, they've really dedicated their lives to this, and they believe very strongly in the words that they've chosen to use and present to the court. And I would just submit that that my clients are, which are not untypical, and I think that for the city, this is really a test case, and they just happened to get unlucky enough to catch people that were represented by counsel at the time. But it's really important to understand that the homeless shelter people in Santa Cruz know that this camping ban should not be enforced under the circumstances. And they're the people that you really look for, because they have the expertise in the area, not lawyers representing interests. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. I know that you're also considering possibly some extra work this summer if you get the funding to actually challenge the sleeping ban.
Well, we'll see if that happens and when that happens. But right now, I just like to keep my my clients and whoever else I can out of jail for just existing.
Of course, jail could be the best shelter they have. It's the new shelter approach, kind of the Cadillac shelter.
Three hots and a cot, from what I understand.
Three bologna sandwiches, at least. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Okay,
thank you for having me.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
Take care, Jonathan.
You too. Sure, we'll meet.
I'll introduce you guys later. David Beauvais, you're still on the line, and you're still tuned, for those of you listening, to 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm sorry we've kept you for half an hour talking about, I think, other issues, though this is an issue that you've grappled with in Santa Cruz on numerous times and spent hundreds of hours working on yourself.
Well, yeah, I'm familiar with those kinds of issues. You know, we've spent a lot of time on that over the years.
So this most recent case, which is the reason actually I had you call in, and if you want, since you have taken so generous a chunk of your time, we could try it another time, or you can talk a little bit about this current case, which has to do with me going to the Metro as a reporter initially to ask that religious sermons not be broadcast on the speakers, but mainly to ask, you know, why were homeless people who were complaining about this treated so rudely and so badly, which was what their concern was. And then myself, of course, I actually got some initial compliance after being turned away from the guard and told that I had to leave. He kind of wouldn't give me his name and his badge number, but his supervisor did turn off the sermons. But when I came back an hour later and was interviewing two people who were, you know, we were all talking together, another guard came up and ordered me to leave the property, and that really became the basis for a trespass citation, which was issued way back in November, and which, you know, you were reluctant to take this case initially. You have to come all the way down from Berkeley. It's just an infraction. It's a sort of a, you know, it's a pain in the ass. And you went to trial on it last Friday. What are your thoughts and comments on it, David?
Well, you know, this is a kind of case that is peculiarly Santa Cruz, and I just don't see this kind of stuff happening in other places. You're in a public place, which the Metro is. It's a public entity.
The Metro is, of course, the bus station for the local buses. I mean, it's and I was outside. I wasn't indoors. I was near the sidewalk.
And you're on public property. You're not on private property. And you're engaged in innocuous behavior that does not interfere with anything that's going on there. And you're, as a journalist, you're collecting information and you're talking to people and recording what they say with their consent.
I mean, we might even say it's First Amendment protected behavior, but that is specific to the Metro and the guards involved who are in response, perhaps defensively, saying, leave the property or we'll have you arrested, which is exactly...
this is a situation where the law is made up on the spot. If somebody doesn't like your behavior, whether or not it's a behavior that has been regulated in some way, you know, it's one thing to publish a set of rules, and everybody knows what they are because they're posted there, and you know, those rules are, you know, usually deemed to be reasonable. And if they're violated, then somebody could tell you, hey, you know, you're violating the rules, you have to leave. I wouldn't have much of a beef with that. But what happened here was you were engaged in an activity which was not disturbing anyone.
Chatting with two other
the
people.
Guard, you know, except the guard who was didn't like you recording what was going on and told you to leave. And then objected that you were recording him telling you to leave. And none of this is, you know, supported by any regulation or rule that says you can't do it. And there's nothing about it which is disruptive or disturbing. So the question then becomes, where does the right come from for a security guard to tell you that you have to leave the property?
Or his supervisor. His supervisor did the same thing as did two police officers.
Right. Right. And so, to me, it was a case of, it's really, although it seems minor because it's only an infraction, it's only a fine, and you're never going to go to jail over this, it is disturbing that you can be routed, you know, out of a public place on the whim of a security guard.
Particularly when you're trying to investigate and talk to the people who are, you know, to some extent complaining about the behavior of the Metro security.
Right.
Right. You know, and I mean, it's you know, there's someone who would say, well, all you got to do is move 5 feet onto the public sidewalk. What's your problem? And my response was sort of, I don't like security guards feeling that they can move people out of public areas into other areas. And, in fact, I'd even heard from a local attorney who complained to me, David Myberg, that he'd been walking along the sidewalk and been told by a security guard to keep walking. The guard then assumed that the public sidewalk was part of the Metro property, although the Metro property may be leased from the city by, you know, an entity which isn't quite... You know, it's not the same thing as the private security guards do patrol the Metro, not the police force. Still, it's open to the public. It's used by the public. It's funded by the public. It's a public facility.
Right.
And this became an issue in the trial, I know, last week. And I know that you may not be terribly comfortable talking about the trial because the matter is under submission. Who knows? The judge may hear this tape and, you know, suddenly take a wrong turn and... Although I think she's taken quite a few already in her thinking on this issue. We're talking about Judge Ariadne Simons of Department 1, where this case took about an hour and a half. But maybe you have some thoughts about the trial which you feel you can state without prejudicing your case. Maybe you don't. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, there were a number of issues that came up in the trial. You know, one of them was the propriety of you being there, recording people, and specifically recording a security guard when he told you he didn't want to be recorded. And
we should say this was...
I think what you pointed out was that you were not the one who engaged him and asked him to make a statement. He came to you and tried to make you go away, and you had every right to report that.
It is true that when he approached me, I asked him for his name and his badge number and his supervisor's name, and he refused to give any of that information, as the prior security guard had refused to give that information when I was trying to get him to address the issue of the religious sermonizing coming over the speakers several hours before. So it is true that in the case of the first security guard, I approached the security guard with a tape recorder in hand, not hidden, but open, requesting some assistance with dealing with what I thought was a public issue. I did approach the first security guard. The second security guard, however, and the one who had me arrested, let us say non-custodially cited and told to and banned from the property for the day, was... It's true. I didn't approach him. He approached us. And I did say to him in a rather aggressive tone, I'd like to know who you are and what your name is, because I was a bit piqued that the previous security guard had been refusing to give that kind of information, which I think is, frankly, it should be common practice by the police if they're engaging in any behaviors with you or in any public employee. So.
Well, I have to agree with you. Police officers are required to give you their name. Usually, most of the time, they're required to wear a name.
Right, and the police officers did when they
are.
The police officers did when
I
they.
I don't know, in the realm of private security.
That's a good question. I don't know either, but it seemed to me that was an appropriate concern, an appropriate thing to record, and something not so much for my benefit. I mean, I don't need to use the public spaces to the extent that poor and homeless people do. They have, a much greater stake in the situation than I do, but they also have much more to lose, and so they can't as easily contest it. And that's one of the reasons I did contest it the way I did. Although probably, I stopped short of going to jail. It was a Sunday. I didn't want to, spend the rest of the weekend in jail. I may have fudged a bit on that. But we did come back 2 weeks later with a whole protest, we were serving soup, we distributed leaflets, we recorded people and asked them their opinions, and the same security guard stood by and did absolutely nothing. He testified in court that he thought that I had been given permission, but of course I was given no such permission, and there's no indication that you have to be given permission to use the Metro. And I say this for the community down here who faces any kind of demands from security guards that they leave the property or that they not give out leaflets on the property. And there's a lot of misunderstanding. I know Vice Mayor Rotkin, who was on the board of directors of the American Civil Liberties Union, the board of directors of the Metro Transit Authority, himself initially told me that it's illegal to leaflet at the Metro. And I told him, watch me. And of course, he found out he was wrong. That it is legal. It is a public place. So people can make mistakes. My concern is that 6 months later, they're still pursuing this case in court. And I know that you've recently gotten a new demand from Judge Simons for a transcript of the 55-minute tape, which will cost at least several hundred dollars, right?
Yes.
Now, this goes into the issue of the judge's behavior, and I know here we're on more sensitive ground because you're concerned, about not prejudicing the judge, and yet at the same time you want to be honest in your analysis. So maybe we should wait until the, June 9th is when the court is going to come back with its decision, although I don't know if on June 9th you feel any more comfortable in being either critical or commending the judge for how she behaved. Is there anything you feel you can say now about how the trial went?
Well, I think that we put on the best case we can, and it's going to be a sad day in Santa Cruz if this judge rules against you, because it means that we are losing our bearings, and there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what our rights are, especially in public places like the Metro.
More important with respect to police agencies. I mean,
this is peculiarly, a Santa Cruz type case because, I don't see these things happening in other places. Now, maybe they are, but I think the case was so clear as it was presented that I was frankly surprised the judge didn't rule on the spot, just say, I'm ruling for the defendant.
I mean, you've heard there's a long 55-minute tape which kind of chronicles this whole thing from my initial conversation with the two homeless people complaining about the problems at the Metro they had all the way to the end when I had an interview with the security guard off the property of the Metro. Is it an inaudible tape? Is it hard for the judge, do you think, to understand or hear the tape that there would be a good reason to require a transcript to...
Well, the transcript idea comes out of a local court rule. And, when it comes to things like rules, they do exist for a reason. And it's nice to know the lay of the land and what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do. But there's also a point at which you have to say, applying this rule in this situation is not the height of wisdom. You know, here you have an infraction case in which the maximum penalty is $248, and you're asking the defendant to spend more than that, probably around $300, to just transcribe a tape that you've offered into evidence to prove your innocence. So there's something disproportionate about that. It's almost like even if you win the case, you were punished because you had to pay $300 for the tape.
And I mean, for me, the issue is, you know, it's possible, you know, I'm sure I can, you know, we'll be able to scrounge up the money somehow. If we don't, however, you as attorney face the possibility of being held in contempt. Do you not?
Well, that goes with the territory if you don't comply with the court order.
And the court has ordered you to have a transcript available. Even though she has the tape and the tape is audible and you can distinguish the voices.
Right. So we're getting a transcript for the judge. It'll be delivered to her next week.
Will we be also delivering, you know, fruit and sausages and bowing low as we do it? I don't know.
I'm hoping I can just email it to her.
Yeah, right.
Kind of impersonal, but
you know, I'm going to say this because I don't expect you to react to it because I know that you are responsibility. You're an officer of the court and all that. But the fact of the matter is, it seems remarkable to me that she somehow felt that it is inappropriate for a member of the public to record either a police officer or a security guard. In fact, you burst out in the trial, as I was saying, you used the word cop watch, which of course is something that originated. Didn't originate, but it's been in Berkeley. It's been an ongoing organization which monitors police behavior and goes out specifically to record police behavior.
Right.
And so I guess you drew a distinction between private security guards and public police officers, but
and the other thing I might want to add to that is that police agencies themselves, in many jurisdictions, have adopted policies of recording themselves every single interaction they have with the public.
And indeed, that's the case to some extent in Santa
Cruz. And there's good reason for that to be done. I mean, on both sides, there's good reason for that.
It allows for a public record and an objective record to be made, assuming that the tape doesn't get edited. And indeed, that's the reason when I go to the police station and request public records and have interactions with the police department personnel, I carry the tape recorder with me. And yet, they refuse to serve me when I do in Santa Cruz, which is interesting. Similarly, when I was filing a complaint about an issue with Captain Steve Clark, he insisted that he would be able to tape record it, but I would not.
Right, and there's nothing in the law that makes that distinction.
Right. So, and the judge, and this is what I noticed and I found most troubling about Judge Simons, who... You know, I'm trying to be, you know, she's relatively new at the job. She hasn't done a lot of infraction cases. I'm trying to think of some positive things to say about her and running out of words. But, you know, I think that you want to give somebody to some extent the benefit of the doubt, though I like to give, I kind of think the opposite way when it comes to judges, actually. They have to prove that they're worth their salt because they have so much power to begin with. But she seemed to be, and she comes from the district attorney's office, like virtually every other judge in Santa Cruz. There are a few exceptions, but not many. She seemed to be like a district attorney operating in judge's robes to me. That is to say, she was asking questions of the witnesses, because normally in an infraction case, all the police can do is present evidence. And if they want to cross-examine the witnesses, that's the business of having a city attorney present, but the city attorney chose not to be present.
Right.
Now, I don't know. I mean, there may have been some changes in court procedures over the years to allow the judge greater discretion. I think there have been. But it just struck me that, you know, you presented some pretty clear arguments, and a lot of them were legal arguments. I mean, we've been talking common sense arguments on the air, like, you know, you for your own protection and for anybody in the future, you record what goes on. So if there's any dispute, you can play the tape. And, you know, should a police officer or a security guard say who they are? Yes. Should the public pay for religious sermons coming out over the loudspeakers on a public agency? No. Should that be corrected fairly quickly? Yes. Should you have to be, you know, threatened with arrest for being on the property? For doing that, no.
Right.
You know, and these are questions that come up pretty clearly, and yet you know, my concern is that 6 months later, we're still proceeding to act as though these issues weren't really simply cut and dried, and the judge, you know, didn't see them that way. But so you presented even more issues, like the fact that there are two laws involved. One law, the law that I wasn't charged with, which is right next law in the code, says you have to give me a notice, a written notice, an offer of appeal, different things of that sort. Yet, instead, both the security guard, the police officers, and the judge all seem to agree as a group that they can pick whatever law they want and use it, even though there's a better law which gives the defendant more rights, which specifically refers to the Metro Transit Authority. I mean, you presented a relatively, I thought, strong and somewhat unanswerable legal argument. Did you think that the judge had any response to that that might have served? I mean, if you imagine she's, you know, because she was acting as a district attorney, did she have an argument that opposed that?
Well, she made some kind of an analogy to a minor in possession of alcohol is a crime that appears in various codes. And, you know, like if it's with a car, it would be in the vehicle code. And if it's, in another place, you know, it might be in some other code, but it's basically the same crime. And the punishment is generally uniform for a violation. And she says, well, you know, the DA could pick and choose among these various codes. But that's not really what I was talking about, because in this instance you have a general trespass statute or ordinance, I should say, because these are all Santa Cruz laws, these are not state laws. There's an ordinance that makes this, you know, trespass in a business establishment, for example, and it doesn't specify whether it's a public or a private business establishment, but it kind of sounds like it's private. And then the next law, as you said, in the ordinance, the municipal code, is a trespass at the metro, which is a very different kind of ordinance from the general trespass ordinance, because it says that you have to be given a letter excluding you from the property. It says that you're entitled to appeal the exclusion and that the exclusion will be stayed, or in other words, they can't enforce it until you've had an appeal, unless you're an immediate threat to property or to people at the metro. So, I mean, you were not given the benefit of any of those procedures that were in that other code section, because they went under the general trespass code section. That is the one that applies to the metro. And so I just simply made the argument that if a legislative body like a city council passes two laws, one generally covering a matter and another one specifically covering something at a specific location, that logic and common sense tell you that you have to proceed under the more specific code, especially when it has procedural protections that you would not have under the other code. Otherwise, why have it on the books? So, and when they pass two laws like that, and they have a more specific law, it's kind of it evidences an intent by the city council that you actually be prosecuted under the more specific code and with its provisions and restrictions and exemption.
And so, in other words, it's both more specific to the place. It was about the metro, and that's in the title of the code. And also, it provides more protections. And I think you said there was some, I don't know if you cited a legal precedent.
And the reason why, you know, it would provide more protections is because it is a public entity. We have the same kind of laws that govern university campuses. State universities, the University of California, there are specific provisions about trespassing on those places, which have very similar things. Because there's the right to appeal, there's the exclusion letter. In fact, I'm willing to bet that the Metro ordinance was patterned after these other laws. And the reason for that is these are public universities, public institutions, and they have a higher standard or higher burden to meet to say you can't come here. You can't come onto this property. Now, if it were Stanford University, they could do whatever they want. because that's a private university. But when you're talking about a public university funded by public dollars, public land, there's a greater measure of protection against exclusion.
Did the judge seem to understand this when you brought it up?
I don't know what the judge understood or didn't understand.
You know, and the second thing she kept claiming was, you know, you also brought up that even if it were true that they had the right to charge me under this, you know, refusal to leave a business when asked to do so, claiming that the Metro is some kind of a business, there are three exceptions there. One is has to do with the UNRRA Civil Rights Act. You don't discriminate against a class of people. The other has to do with common carriers, the rights of the public regarding common carriers, which in a way the Metro is a common carrier, right?
Yes.
And then thirdly, that the thing you brought up in court, that if it has to do with freedom of speech and association and constitutional protections, that's the third exception. So even granted the law that they cited me under, which they wrongly cited using that law, and I think it's important for homeless people to know that, because the homeless people should have as much protection as possible, you know, to be protected essentially from, I don't even have to call it bigotry, but it's preemptive behavior by security guards who might feel that, you know, they're protecting the public interest by not having people who look poor hanging around on public property. We're talking with David Beauvais, and I've got about a minute left. David, I'm going to give you a chance to sum up and apologize for, you know, taking up most of your speaking time, but we do have we're running up with time constraints, and I want to thank you for coming on the air.
That's no problem. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. I'm hoping for a good result. I hope that that the judges will recognize that these are important issues.
And of course, there will be no appeal, right? Because it would cost thousands of dollars to appeal this damn thing.
Well, you know, it depends on whether you get a lawyer to do it pro bono or not.
Hey.
If it were to be charged, you know, if it were to be charged as a regular case, I mean, yeah, it would be thousands of dollars.
But you think a civil lawsuit can come out of this?
Potentially, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not focused on that at this point.
I'll be curious to read the transcript. I'm going to try to get a copy of the trial so we can actually play it on the air. Probably people are thoroughly sick of this whole matter, we have a new voice heard from in the studio. That man about the environment and Mr. Nostalgia, as I call him, Uncle Dennis, who will be joining us from the cream to the dregs. David Beauvais, thank you very much for coming on the air. I'll talk to you more later.
Okay, take care, Robert.
Yeah, you too, man.
Bye-bye.
That's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. We're going to be rolling out of the studio now, and I'll be back. There is no hearing for Anna and Miguel tomorrow. It has been moved to 10 a.m. a week from Friday on May 29th. However, there will be a protest at Jack's, the hamburger joint that's kitty corner from the farmer's market on Lincoln and Cedar Streets, because they are systematically excluding homeless people. That'll be happening 3 o'clock on Wednesday. So show up then. We have a caller. I'm going to hand this over to Dennis, but let's see who's on the air line. Hi, who's there? You're on free radio.
Hello, Robert.
Yes, John, what's up?
I just wanted to make one quick comment.
Okay.
It is actually illegal to flyer the Metro in San Jose. They have that written into the municipal code in San Jose that there are certain exclusion zones for flyering, such as they have a whole objectors list of people you can't flyer next to. And one of the objectors is the Metro Center.
Interesting. Let's talk. Yeah. In fact, I'd like to hear more about that maybe on Sunday, or give me a call off air. We can talk more about it. There's no such provision in the Santa Cruz code as far as I know.
Yeah, right.
Thank
right.
God. Thank you very much, John.
Yeah, bye.
They'll do it.
They probably will. And so get in touch with me between times. Is the Metro giving you trouble? You're getting hassled on the street? Are you being arrested for sleeping? You know, whatever reports you've got, please call in 423-HUFF. Human Rights Organization meets on Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe. Stuff is happening there, too, and you might want to come check that out. And I'll be back on Sunday morning, 9:30 in the morning, probably a little before. In the meantime, be nice to Uncle Dennis, and he may be nice to you.
Falling all around. Time.
doesn't stay. But now it's time for me to go. The autumn moonlight's my way. But now I smell the rain, and with it came, and it's heading my way. Sometimes I grow so tired.
Cut off all their hair. I don't care. finished yet, brother. Got more to say. White collar conservative flashing down the street, pointing their plastic finger at me. They're hoping soon my kind will drop and die, but I'm gonna wave my freak flag high. Wow! Just don't fall on me. Go ahead on, Mr. Businessman. You can't dress like me. Yeah. Let me live my life.